Work shouldn't feel like a drag, and you shouldn't have to sacrifice your soul for a job you love. Determined to rethink the future of work, she's out of her depth on purpose. With fresh ideas, interviews, and stories from her life on the road, meet Europe's newest digital nomad, Blair Palmer.
Hello, and welcome to episode 95 of A Brilliant Gamble. I hope you are really well. As I mentioned last week, I'm pressing pause on some aspects of my life at the moment, just while we get settled in the new house. But I wanted to bring you some of my favourite shows from the past, so you'd still have inspiration as you consider how you want to create a life that really works for you. This interview is with the lovely Jez Rose, behaviourist and author, and someone I know from the conference scene. We've spoken at a few of the same events. We talked about his work, his energy, his bees, which I've since invested in with the sponsors of half of one of his hives. We talked small holdings and, most importantly, connecting with nature and how that affects us as human beings. I hope you enjoy the show. It's with great pleasure that I welcome this week's guest. He is behaviourist, broadcaster, award-winning author, and faculty leader of the Good Life Project, Jez Rose. Hello, Jez.
Hello, lovely Blair.
You all right?
I'm lovely, thanks. This feels so strange to be chatting to somebody that I consider a almost friend.
Almost?
in such a formal setting. I hope I don't let you down. I feel a little nervous.
No, you won't. You won't let me down. But I feel quite excited in a very nice way, because I'm a little in awe of you, if I'm honest, Jez. don't laugh. I'm being serious. We met when we were doing a series of events together for a company that was running some road shows. And one of the things I didn't mention in that introduction of you is that you're a very talented, very inspirational keynote speaker. And you were the keynote speaker at this series of events. And I got to see your speech four times.
I know, poor you. Yeah, it was great. And then you didn't talk to me for a year.
Yeah, but then, you know, I got over it and I picked
it wore
up.
Off.
And now we're furs, which is good. So, but I was really impressed. And one of the things I was impressed by is your energy, the amount of energy that you're able to muster every time you give a presentation. And I just, is that because you love it? Is it because you get excited? Where does all of that energy come from?
So it's genuine energy. It's not... It's not artificial. The reason I say that is there's a diversion real quick. There was a funny thing that happened quite a long time ago. So this year I've been speaking, and most people know me as a speaker, but that's not really my main job. But so for 13 years this year, I've been speaking at conferences. And about 10 years ago, I used to have this attention strategy whereby I would regularly bring my hands close to my face or just sort of casually touch my nose to bring people's attention towards my face and towards me. And because I am quite energetic when I present, the client asked via my agent whether I was on drugs, because they sort of put the energy and the touching my nose together and figured that maybe that would make four. So I just want to just put that out there now, that it's natural energy. Yes, to answer your question very succinctly, I love to people, and the potential that people have really fascinates me every day. It makes me get up in the morning. It drives me. What I love is talking to people that look disinterested and disengaged. I love that even more. Don't get me wrong. Like, I love it when there's a group of people that totally understand your message. They want to learn it. They want to deliver it. And they want to take it on board and make a difference. But I equally love taking people from point A, where disengaged, bored, uninterested, don't see the point, to point B, where they say, oh, I've had it. It's like a revelationary moment. So the energy is, I think, just comes from sometimes you, in order to get other people to do things differently, it's the energy that's going to drive them to do it. You can't just say, oh, you know, maybe you should try this. It's passion that drives people. And if there's no passion in the room, or there is less passion, I find that by me providing the passion, it helps drive them quicker to a point cerebrally where they can start thinking about things differently.
And you're a behaviorist. I want to know quite what that is. But is that what you're excited about? Or what is it exactly that drives this energy that you have in everything that you're doing right now?
Well, look, this is going to sound so remarkably corny, but it is true. There is no bookie that will give you odds for waking up tomorrow morning, right? And in the last 5 years, I've lost so many people that were close to me and meant a whole lot to me that my life feels sincerely, personally, a little less enriched than it did. And we can all relate to that. I'm not saying that I stand out in any way because of that. But it does surprise me every day by people who don't push, they don't passionately drive, they just live life as if it was only a rehearsal and that they got to do it again at some point. And then, you know, they work their grumpy ass off until they're 65 so that they can retire and get out of this terrible, you know, hellhole that they work in, and then they die. So I'm constantly reminded of that. And my background's the NHS, so every day I was dealing with people that, you know, were ill or unwell. And I think that sincerely is what drives me. And crikey, we don't get to do it again, right? So I'm going to make sure that everything that happens in my life is as positive as possible, but realistic. You know, I'm realistic enough to know that life's quite a complicated thing. But I certainly want to try and make it as positive and as happy as possible, and that we do things that are greater than just ordinary. You know, I mean, that's where this, I've become relatively well known for the phrase be extraordinary, and this notion of from ordinary to extraordinary. And that's where that's driven from, because, you know, being ordinary is easy and it doesn't really bring you anything of interest or any engagement or any significant happiness. So, you know, if we set the bar high, we've got so much more to play with in life. So I think that's what drives everything I do. I'm talking slightly out of context, and I realize I probably sound my tones change because I'm thinking at the same time as talking. Because it's not like I have a stock answer. Like, people ask me that all the time. Does that help? Does that explain it, or have I just gone off on a tangent?
No, I think it really does. And I know it's true for you. And we're going to come on in a minute to talk about the Good Life Project and what that is and what it means. But you and I you're slightly a few steps ahead of me in terms of the stuff that we want to do in this area. But for me, the plan to sell up and move to a small and get the animals and grow the veg and all of that, it's part of the same thing. It's something that I imagine doing later. I imagine doing it, you know, in my 50s as I was heading towards retirement, so I'd have something to do in my retirement. Why would I wait when I could have it now? I mean, there's no reason why I couldn't have it now. And so I started getting things moving. And I think that it's quite a common disease, if you like, for people to think, one day I will whatever, fill in the gap of the thing that lights you up. And of course, meanwhile, you're not doing the thing that lights you up, and life is passing you by. And like you say, there's no guarantee that that time is going to come. The only thing we know is we have now. And that's it.
Sure. I mean, it sounds pretty morbid, but it is true. You know, it's the same way that people don't talk about. This is going off on a ridiculous tangent. What I was going to say was, it's the same way that people don't really talk about death, they don't really talk about personal issues, they don't talk about toileting, they don't talk about all the things that are normal for our species. And yet there are so many things that socially just either get, maybe consciously or subconsciously, just sort of, you know, brushed under the carpet or whatever. And this idea of doing what you want to do right now, I think for me it's compounded by the fact that I am quite impatient. I have a very strange relationship with patience. I am impatience to a fault of my own ability and my own workload. I'm remarkably patient with other people, yet that compounds or exacerbates this notion of wanting to do, you know, things now and do as much as possible now. So my grandma always used to say, grass will never grow under your feet, which I thought was an odd thing to say, because if you stood still, grass would never grow under your feet, because obviously it would have no light or opportunity for photosynthesize. But I think what she meant was, you know, there will never be opportunity for things to just sort of, you know, grow old and tired because I'm always onto something new.
Yeah. So I want to get into some stuff about what you're doing, but I just want to really get clear about what this term behaviorist is, because I'm not sure I've ever met one before. So,
so it's not a new thing. No. So our founding grandfather was B.F. Skinner, and Skinner is often very well known for Skinner's box. Which was, he's the founding father of behaviorism. He was the first person that linked sort of an application of the fact that there's a certain formula, if you like, to behavior and the way that it can be modeled. And there's a lot of stuff that's misprinted about Skinner, actually a fascinating man, real family man. There was a lot of lies and negativity that went around about some of the things he did. So for example, one of the famous studies was that he would have rats in a cage, in a normal cage, like a rat cage, mouse cage, whatever. And they would be taught to tap a lever for food. So every time they learned very quickly that if they pressed the lever, they got a piece of food. And so there was this sort of reward mechanism that he was able to model their behavior. And so he could get them tapping levers. And when they did things wrong, they would get an electric shock. And of course, now in 2017, without wanting to date your podcast, but the people are in uproar about, you know, that how terrible that was. And actually, if you look across the whole history of psychology and behavior, there have been some remarkably awful experiments. But back then we didn't know, right? So that's the thing I have to keep reminding people is, in context, yes, right now, if somebody was electrocuting rats to learn about behavior, it probably would be frowned upon. But at the time, in the 50s, nobody knew any different and it was just accepted. So a behaviorist fundamentally observes and quantifies behavior. That is what a behaviorist does. And you have animal behaviorists and human behaviorists and social behaviorists and all sorts. And so in context, I suppose it basically means it's a posh word for a pervert, because by virtue of the definition, I guess, get to sit and watch people. The only difference is I don't do that weird thigh rubbing thing and smack my lips at the same time. So that is ostensibly what a behaviorist does. And what I did is I applied the notion of observing and quantifying behavior and understanding why we do the things we do and how we can change them for the better, obviously, otherwise that would make me a serial killer, and applying that into the organizational and corporate structure and education as well. Those are sort of the two areas that I am most interested in. I trained as an FE, further education teacher, so I have an interest in education and learning.
There's a lot of things that we could talk about, clearly, and we could go off in all sorts of directions, but the thing that I really wanted to talk to you about today was the new project, in a sense, the Good Life Project. And clearly that's partly related to all the behavioral stuff. So how our environment and how what we do affects the results that we get in our lives. So if you could just maybe explain what the Good Life Project is and where your interest in that started.
Yeah. So the Good Life Project is a research project that's evidencing the impact of nature on health, well-being and behavior, predominantly in the workplace. So we're looking at the cognitive and biological impact of, and physiological impact as well, of having greater contact with nature. That's it in a nutshell. There's a faculty of 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 of us. and we are blessed to have Professor Mark Salem, who was involved actually in the early stages of Sesame Street. He's an educational psychologist and has some great input in terms of people on the faculty, and a neuroscientist and a psychologist. And we look at the most cost-effective but efficacious ways for organizations to have their employees engage with nature that will do things such as reduce attrition, reduce sickness, reduce stress and episodes of illness and long-term sickness, whilst improving efficiency and happiness and well-being and reducing incidence of complicated behaviours. So there's a real broad spectrum in terms of its appeal and its output. And where it came from is, so I grew up in the middle of the countryside, surrounded by fields. And during my sort of formative years, that's where I grew up, and was heavily affected by that. I became a much happier person and a much, I spent a lot of time thinking, you know, and came up with great ideas while I was in the middle of, you know, a field or whatever. And then I moved away to a city, and then I moved to a sort of suburban sort of place. And I read a lot. I really only read biographies and research, academic research. So I'm the life and soul of a party. Through reading lots of this, I was beginning to think about what it was that businesses could do differently that they haven't already done based on a whole body of research. And then a client of mine proudly told me how they were moving to a hot desking principle where nobody would have their own desk. And so obviously there had to be rules. And one of the rules was you're not allowed to personalize your desks. And I thought, I just instinctively think that doesn't work. And I'm fairly certain that my professional head is twitching now and thinking that won't work, that's a degrading way of working. And I'm sure there's some research on that. And that same week, another client of mine told me that they were up in arms because senior management had discovered that somebody had forgotten to water the plants in the office. And that somebody was somebody who inconveniently had become pregnant and nobody had thought about perhaps replacing the the plant waterer. So they banned plants in the workplace. And I thought, I don't think that's good either. So I started doing all this research and discovered not a massive amount, but enough pieces of research since the 70s with significant evidence-based results that demonstrate that being around nature and seeing nature has a difference to our health, our well-being, and our behavior. And so I thought, well, I want to do that. I want to do something with that. Isn't that remarkable that just by looking at nature, you could feel better? So I started speaking to clients about it and started this idea of the research project. And at the same time, a little advertising marketing leaflet came through our 3-bed semi-suburban house saying, you know, Mrs. B wants to buy your house. And I joked to my wife and I said, wouldn't it be funny if Mrs. B did pay that much for our house? Because that's way worth more than we thought it was. So we had it valued as a bit of a joke. At the end of that week, we'd sold it. So I said, well, let's put our money where our mouth is. If we're really, you know, I love being around the countryside. I'm a bit of a farmer boy. And if I know that it's going to make that much of a difference to people, maybe we should prove it. So we up sticks and bought a farm in the middle of Cambridgeshire. Just to really make a point of telling people that, you know, I know this is right. There's a lot of evidence. There's going to be more evidence. We've started doing research. And now we've created on our farm a sort of an atmosphere, a center, if you like, where people can come. We can show them the research results. We can show them what it's like to interact with nature. And we can give them real simple, very, very cost-effective, many times free, actually, but efficacious ways that they can engage with nature back in their workplace. And then also strategies for measuring that so they can demonstrate to key stakeholders, finance people, CEOs, investors, whatever, that it does actually work. The biggest challenge, Blair, is that people think they're really complicated. And people like to think that, you know, that we require or desire or deserve complex strategies and solutions because of, you know, how wonderful we are as people, and actually forget that it's the simplest of things that can actually create the most extraordinary results.
So I want to know, I mean, I've actually been up, of course, you know this, but the person listening doesn't
When were you here?
I was there, Jess. I don't know if you remember. I
remember the hair.
I want to talk about what you're actually doing over there. But I think before we do that, some of the evidence might be really interesting. And I know you're not at the point of being, you know, having tons and tons of evidence gathered. Yeah. This is quite a new thing. But what is the proof that connecting with nature, that interacting with nature has any proper bottom line impact on our ability to be efficient or to be happy or to prevent illness or prevent stress or minimize stress? What's the evidence so far?
So I suppose the thing we must talk about is a landmark piece of research, which I suppose anybody in the field of what we would term as with people in mind, they often cite. And that is the Ulrich study, which ran from 1978, I think, to 1982 by memory. And in essence, he took two groups of patients recovering from abdominal surgery, 12 in one ward, very similar age groups and exactly the same operation, same, very, very similar clinical safety markers, et cetera, et cetera. And those 12 people could see out of their ward window, trees in sort of a natural setting, so nature. The other comparative cohort was 12 people, again, recovering from the same surgery, who either had no view because of the way their beds were positioned or could see bricks, sort of concrete structures from their view. And the group of 12 patients who could see nature from their window recovered quicker, had a shorter recovery time, they had less post-surgical complications, they required less analgesia, so less pain relief, and all round recovered quicker than those who couldn't. So it's a very small cohort. However, it's a remarkable difference. And then you fast forward, and there have been lots of different things. I mean, we have a cohort of, this will sound significant, but from 400 to 6,000. So we have 400 people who regularly engage with the research, and we have a body of 6,000 that we can pull from for different pieces of research. 76% say that displaying images of nature, which could be flowers or countryside landscapes or trees, we have three different types of study. To try and determine whether it's flowers that make a difference. If you can see flowers or pictures of flowers, does it need to be trees or is it just general countryside landscape? So I wanted to know from very early on if there was a difference in those three different areas. And 76% said that it made them feel more relaxed and their environment more enjoyable to be in. That's critical, which I imagine we'll end up talking about at some point today, but certainly you will understand just how important it is for individuals to enjoy the environment that they're working in. Pot plants and desktop herb gardens. When people come here for some of the training, or we did a training in their workspace, we get them to make a herb garden that they can put on the desktop so people can pick the herbs and cook with them and, you know, all that kind of jazz. It's quite social, but you see the herbs all the time, and of course you can smell them and water them or whatever. More than 80% said they felt more happy and engaged with nature. Displaying a pot plant on your desk resulted in a 17 to 22% increase in productivity and efficiency. Over 60% of the cohort agreed that naturally scented candles made them feel more relaxed and less stressed. I could go on, but there's no negative impact yet that we've seen. And it's significant because in this country alone, the average number of workplace minor illness absence, so that's coughs, colds, I don't know, sprained your ankle, headache, whatever, is 6.9 days per year per person on average. So obviously you get some people who have never been off sick, but of course somebody else might have been off for 8.2 days, in which case it averages out. And somebody, I think it was somebody to do with HR, I forget, I can't cite that study, but they worked out that it was about £554 as a cost to the employer every year. It's epic. It runs into hundreds of millions that it costs the UK economy. And that's just on illness and sickness. So that's before you even start talking about efficiency and the effect that enjoying going to work has on teamwork, has on customer service, has on, we could go on and on and on and on and on. So in terms of evidence, we're building some. We're not the only people. There are quite a number of universities now that are also interested in it. And you know what the relevant thing, Blair, is? Last year, 2016, we prescribed more antidepressants and more medicines for high blood pressure than ever before in the history of humanity. Now, isn't that remarkable to think that the answer, actually, because of studies that have shown that engaging with nature helps reduce blood pressure, helps reduce levels of stress, boosts alpha brain waves, boosts serotonin, oxytocin, dopamine, all the positive neurochemicals that that reduce the impact of depression, is all around us. Like, the answer is free, and it's for most people in this country, because we have a very rural, leafy country, is easily accessible and doesn't require any medicines. And I think that is something we seriously need to start looking at more. The problem, and you find this with meditation, mindfulness, all of the sort of quote-unquote fluffy things that people start to look at, is that we don't talk about them enough and people dismiss them because they think that we're more complicated or should be more complicated, or that, meditation for 10 minutes a day isn't a serious enough thing. I mean, it is nuts. What the things people come up with on their own, without asking questions, without asking for evidence, the information people accept is just remarkable. It's one of the things that infuriates me about our species as much as it does engages me and interests me.
There's so much in there that I want to pick up on, because one of
I'm sorry.
No, it's brilliant. I mean, it's very, very rich. And one of the things that I'm just still slightly open-mouthed about is how little it takes. I mean, you said images of nature. We're not even talking about having. No. I did some research for this conversation with you, and I found lots of examples of companies around the world that have roof gardens, that have allotments, that have various schemes for getting their employees out and actually working the land as part of their working day. You're not even talking about that. You're talking about a picture of a flower that you can see while you work.
Yeah, it's nuts, isn't it? I mean, the gold standard always is to be immersed with nature. And the Good Life Project has two key ambassadors. One of them is the Soil Association, who are sort of the governing body, if you like, of organic growing and produce. And we are currently undergoing certification to be organic here on our farm. And the reason I mentioned that is because physical contact with soil, specifically soil, has been shown to reduce levels of depression and stress. And there's something quite cathartic and natural in every sense of the word about dealing with soil and the hands-on sense of handling soil and potting things and growing. And it's used so much, and with wonderful increasing amounts, with people with learning difficulties and disabilities, to engage and feel happier about what they're doing. And of course, they can create something with very, very wide margins for interpretation. I was going to say failure. That would sound terrible. What I mean is, it doesn't matter if they get it wrong. It doesn't matter if you spill a load of soil on the floor. It doesn't matter if you don't quite put enough in the pot. So determined by your ability or your disability, it doesn't matter quite what you do with the soil. But the very fact is that you can grow something. And it's very forgiving, generally plants are very forgiving. So there's something wonderful about being in contact with it. The other ambassador is the broadcaster Kate Humble. And she talked very much about how, she grew up in the countryside, moved to the city, and then sort of didn't really feel right and needed that connection. As soon as she moved to the countryside, there was that anecdotal evidence, you know, it's many people talk about just how much more relaxed and engaged she felt. So the gold standard is absolutely being in it. But I knew that if we went to businesses and said, look, here's the evidence, actually your staff will be happier and they'll work more efficiently and they'll be off sick less. If you, I don't know, plant a tree or have hug a pig day on a Friday or bring in a pet in zoo once a month or, you know, turn the canteen into a veg patch, I know they would all turn around and say, that's too expensive. It's not practical. We don't care that they'll be less happy, less efficient and more stressed. Whereas if I can say, this is the gold standard. Now we're trying to work out what the most cost-effective but yet efficacious results are. And we're seeing that actually just seeing images of nature has a similar effect, then I know that they're much more likely to engage in it. And then the next step is encouraging them to get into a more physical contact with nature. Does that make sense?
Yeah, yeah. And I was wondering about that because I was wondering what sort of response you had. So when I tell teams that I work with, oh yeah, in 2 to 3 years time, it's going to be possible for your team to come into my converted barn or my circle of yurts or whatever it is and do the work that we're doing out there, they're really enthusiastic, really enthusiastic. Uh-huh. They sign me up. If I was to say, next week, would you like to come to my circle of yurts?
Yes.
or work in my barn, that I might not get the same enthusiasm. I think people are, they get it theoretically and they love the idea of it, but practically speaking, if it's a choice between disappearing off to a farm or off to your company allotments for 2 or 3 hours or 2 or 3 days versus is there something we can do here in the office while we're answering emails, I think at the moment they're more likely to go for the latter, aren't they?
Sure. We have to remember that we're lazy. As a species, we're a phenomenally lazy species, and you see demonstrations of that all the time. That's not me being flippant. We really are, yeah? Because it's a sort of rogue and probably unnecessary behaviour now. But developmentally, you know, we are built to conserve energy and built to conserve emotion and stress. So that's why most people compartmentalise emotion and issues. And I tell them all the time not to do it, because just because you've compartmentalized it now and put that issue in a little box and tucked it away to the back of your head, at some point it will burst out like a jack in a box and rugby tackle you to the ground and force you to deal with it, probably most likely at the least inconvenient time. Sorry, at the most inconvenient time. So we do that a lot. Go to any public space where there is a path that clearly defines the route of walking. And you will find that people cut the corners of the path, or the grass is worn on the corner because it was quicker to cut the corner than it was to go around. It's why people delegate so much. It's why people work in teams and feel secure by working in teams, because it means that other people pick up the slack. You see it all the time. That's okay. It's normal. We just need to know what to do about that. But that's why people love the idea of these things, but there's, you know, always a restriction to actually do something about it, because it means taking the next logical step. And we found, little tip for you here, when you end up with Blair's Llama World, we found that making it fun seems to be the thing that makes people want to do it. That's the sort of the step to engagement, is that like chicken training, for example. So
okay, tell me about the chicken training.
So real quick, right? This is just a point of in context, is that everybody, well, not everybody, there are lots of people that do management training and lots of people that tell you how to be a better leader or a better manager or whatever. And I have said for years that I don't think anybody should be allowed to be a manager unless they first learned how to train a chicken, right? Because chickens are phenomenally unforgiving. Like, if you get it wrong, it will just keep doing the thing that you taught it to do when you reinforced it at the wrong time, or it will get bored and walk off. So you have to know exactly what you're going to do before you do it. You have to be absolutely sharp about reinforcing. You have to know what punishment is effective, what reinforcement is effective. That's another thing that annoys me. When you talk about punishment and everybody gets all like, and they go, oh my God, he's talking about punishing a chicken or punishing a human. And you know, the definition of punishment is an act or behavior that reduces the immediately preceding behavior to a level that it doesn't happen again. Says nothing about being punitive, nothing about being nasty. You know, you don't have to hit people to punish them. You don't have to lock them away for hundreds of years. So I discovered very quickly that, you know, if you're just talking about management and leadership and all the rest of it, it wasn't really, didn't seem very engaging. It wasn't enough to have somebody say, yeah, that's what I want to do. I want to make a difference as a manager. I want to do something differently. Suddenly, when we talk about chicken training, and I teach you how to train a chicken, and then how all of those skills, all of them, directly apply to you as a manager or a leader, and then we apply them using interactive, you know, games and strategies to directly into your business. Suddenly, it, you know, it becomes much more engaging. People are much more interested in it. They love it. At the end of it, they say, "Oh, you know, I never thought I could apply that, that, and that. I never thought about doing it differently that way before." And some of the things that we talk about, and I'm very open about this in the workshop, some of the things we talk about are not new. You just think they're new because you didn't do anything with it before. And we've done it in a way that is more interesting to you. Therefore, selfishly, you're now more interested in it and you're going to behave differently towards the people in your charge. So I think, look, you know, you need to do llama riding for managers when you set up your when you set up your farm.
Absolutely. Llama wrangling, something like
yes, that. Yes, that's exactly it, right?
So what's the, well, okay, what is the key lesson? I'm slightly obsessed by the chicken training. So what's the theme that comes out most commonly from the chicken training? What are people coming away with that they already know, but that the chicken training has reinforcing them and suddenly they really get it?
Oh, that's a good question. I think probably the two things are that preparation and understanding what you are doing and where you are going, what your journey is, and having that absolutely planned out and you yourself know where you're going and what you're going to do is critical, is key. You can't make it up as you go along. It's less effective, which everyone knows, right? But people do fall into the trap of making up as they go along. Why? Because we're lazy. Because it's easier to do it that way, right? It takes less effort. And probably the second thing that they know inherently that people like different things, but they fall into the trap of blanket reinforcement. So what I mean by that is very, very commonly, and you will have a similar thing, you know, when you speak at conferences or you're invited to train organizations all over the world, it's the same, where people will have an awards ceremony, for example, and everybody gets a bottle of champagne. Well, what if you don't drink alcohol? What if you can't drink alcohol? What if you don't like champagne? Those things aren't reinforcing, right? In the same way that some people don't like having their head touched or their neck or their shoulders touched. So if you were to pat somebody on the head and say, good job, well done, that wouldn't be reinforcing. And we have an interesting combination in that some of the chickens love a particular grain, and some of them prefer a different one, and some of them actually prefer kale or greens, brassicas. So working out what each of the people in your team find more reinforcing or of value is critical to modeling behavior. And they inherently know that, but, you know, the chicken really does prove that point. I watched a lady offering the chicken. The chicken had done the thing that she asked it to do. It was pecking the correct colour. And she offered it a cup of grain, and it walked off because it didn't want the grain. So she chased it around the room, trying to force it to have this treat. Like forcing it to like the thing that she had chosen it should be reinforced with. And as funny as it was probably the strongest learning curve and the strongest takeaway. I'm trying to think of the word, conclusive part of that training, that actually you can't force somebody to do something and you can't force them to like the thing that you think they should like as a reward in the hope that they'll do it again. It's a little bit more complicated than that.
Yeah. I'm learning to ride a horse at the moment. And I did used to ride when I was a kid, but I hadn't been on a horse in 20 years or something. And
is it like riding a bike?
It's not at all like riding a bike. Not at all. One thing, your body is completely different 20 years later. So you don't you know, where you used to have muscle. So, but also, it's a living thing that, you know, that you're riding.
Okay. And the fundamental difference between a bike.
Basically, a pretty basic difference. And it has its own wants and its own, you know, motivations and its own personality and all of that. And so I'm riding yesterday and I'm learning to canter right now. And I mean, the poor horse, Chesney, poor Chesney. Well, for one thing, I do feel bad about his name. And he's beautiful. He's absolutely beautiful. And I trust him completely. But he's basically, with me, got a sack of potatoes on his back. Anyway, so the teacher is telling me to look where I want him to go.
Yes.
Telling him where I want to go is not about the reins, because I haven't, in canter at the moment, I don't have a lot of control over the reins because I'm just barely clinging on, you know, to
yes.
So I'm not really able to do that. But she says, look where you're going. And so I turn my head a bit. He doesn't have a clue. And she says, okay, you're really not looking where you're going. I said, I really am trying. Yeah. I'm also trying to stay on, you know. And then she says, now really, really twist your body. So the next time round, I twist really round to the left. And surprise, surprise, Chesney goes where I want him to go. Mm-hmm. It's the same message, really, which is that the horse is responding to things that don't have anything to do with your age, the size of car that, you know, the kind of car that you drive, how fancy your job title. The horse is responding to your energy and to your body and to your intention. Yes. And that's about it. And if you don't really commit to we're going left here, then it doesn't go left.
Yes.
Where it's going. And I do, it's one of my strong motivations for getting people out of the office and into different environments. And it's almost as though, yes, animals are a great teacher in this way, but it wouldn't matter what it was. If you take yourself away from the habits that are deeply formed because you're doing something familiar, mm-hmm. and you put yourself into a position where you're doing something unfamiliar.
Yes.
The lessons that can be drawn from that are really powerful and very memorable because they happened in a sort of quite unusual, unique situation.
Sure.
So in addition to the nature aspect, I wonder if there's also just the difference aspect, the kind of, this is new. It's the same reason that you touch your nose. It's the can I draw your attention to something different to get you out of your habits of thinking and your habits?
Yeah.
Of
I have a question. Is cantering the one where you run really fast?
Cantering, so you've got walking, then yes. trotting where you're going up and down, and then cantering, yes. Yeah, that's ba-dum, ba-dum, ba-dum. You're going, you're not actually necessarily going that fast, but it's a completely different rolling motion.
Is it not slightly remiss of your horse teacher to ensure that you can actually go left or right or steer the animal before you start going at speed?
No, she's very good. I mean, I have been learning for...
It doesn't sound very good.
And I'm really, really secure in walk and trot. So there's nowhere else to go now but to the next
right. step.
And it's well, going to be...
Left and right, I would argue. Yeah. Probably.
Well, left and right and trot is a different thing, you know, because I'm very secure. But the horse... This is slightly off the point, but the horse is only going to go round and around the school. So the worst thing that happens is that the horse is going to go in the direction that you're going, or eventually just stop. So nothing.
I didn't realise you were learning on a caged animal. I'm sorry. So the
in a very small, very safe, and Chesney's not going to jump the fence.
Chesney. So coming back to what you were saying, I have a maxim that if it looks the same, it feels the same. And this is why I've always, always been an advocate of getting out of the environment you're in. So, and I've done it all over the world. It doesn't matter. If the weather is good, we're going outside. If there is another room that I can do my session in that isn't the room you've been in all day, that's the one I'd love to do. Now, don't get me wrong, 80% of the time it's not possible. There is a room that 1,000 people are sat in, the time it takes to get 1,000 people somewhere else, the logistics of that are a nightmare. There's no reason to have another room that fits 1,000 people, so it doesn't happen. when it does happen, it's pure magic. And I mean that sincerely. So I ran a conference. I didn't run a conference. I was running a long training session at a conference at a hotel in the Lake District. And the weather was lovely. And I said to the client, I said, any chance, I've been for a walk around because I stayed at the hotel, this amazing waterfall and like a bit of a clearing in this woods where this waterfall was. I said, would you be totally averse to me just going out and we'll do my session out there? He said, well, no, I guess not. Yeah, so somebody carried my flip chart, someone carried the pens, off we went. Took, I don't know, 5 minutes to get 300 people to this waterfall. And we had an absolute whale of a time. Like, people rated that session the best that they'd ever had in their life. It was, you know, the most amazing training. We got really, really, really great answers out of the activities that we ran. Nothing to do with me, Blair. I'm just a conduit. That's, you know, it's never about me. It's about them. And we are a product of our environment. And if I can get you out of a stale office, the office you're in all the time, if it looks the same, it feels the same. And so if you can come to the farm, whether it be Blair's Llama World or whether it be the Good Life Project farm, and you can experience something different, two wonderful things happen. Two significant studies have shown that within a period of about 3 months, if you're only told something, you remember about 10% of it. But if you're told it, you're shown it, and you experience it, so if you have full cognitive and emotional engagement with the thing that you're learning, you remember 65%. That's a massive difference. And the reason is because of how we engage with our environment and how we engage with, you know, what happens when we're learning. The same way that I hate the fact that at most conferences, people just shove their face full of sweets on the table or fried food during the, you know, the lunches and stuff. They don't get any choice, but they're there, so they eat them, and then they end up with sugar highs and lows and carbohydrate crashes. And then they, you know, the people who run the conferences wonder why nothing really changes when they get back to work. These poor people have been dragged through this this abuse on their bodies all day. So I think it absolutely is about showing people something different, experiencing something different, but not just because it might be nice. It has a real fundamental psychological impact on the way we engage with that difference.
So you said earlier on, you know, it started off with a bit of research and it's turned into a massive change of lifestyle.
Yes.
And you now live in this gorgeous old house with, you've just converted the barn into a sort of learning centre, I guess.
Well, we built the barn. We didn't convert it. That was brand new.
You built that. Wow. I didn't even know that. Yeah. And you've got this lovely bit of land and some veg and all of that and the opportunity to grow it out. I know, because I grew up on a small holding, that beautiful as this stuff looks, it looks idyllic, it's not always always happy days when you wake up in the morning and, you know, you're facing all of that. Have there been any low points since you made this massive change of lifestyle?
How long do we have? I'm not kidding. Like, seriously, this could dominate the conversation. Yes is the simple answer. Many, weekly. Mrs. Jez and I moved in. Oh my gosh! Blair Palmer. Mrs. Jez moved in 6 months ago to the day that this is being recorded.
Wow.
Look at that. Aren't you a little bit sneaky and clever? Huh. You little turnip.
Yes. Completely, but synchronicitous intentionally.
Yes. 6 months ago today. I wasn't there, naturally.
You were giving a speech somewhere, I think.
Yes, I was, yeah. Poor woman moved on her own. I was away for the rest of that week. So when we moved in, it was pretty dilapidated, more dilapidated than we thought. Typical farmhouse. Most farmers are have-a-go heroes when it comes to pretty much everything. Like, you know, if they reckon they can probably give it a go or get away with it, then they will. And so we moved into a house where it inherited every problem under the sun. It has been the worst thing I've ever done in my life, and the most exciting and the most rewarding in equal measure. And in those 6 months, gosh, I can't believe that, how lovely. In those 6 months, we have done more than we anticipated to do because of the problems that kept arriving that we couldn't not do anything about. So we took much more on than we wanted. And I wanted to get to the point where people could enjoy it. But of course, you can't just have, you know, a whole load of land that has nothing on it and looks pretty dull and uninspiring when you're trying to encourage people to get out in nature because of how inspiring it is. So, and there weren't any paths, you know, and it was muddy and yeah, so we had to put in a lot of infrastructure, a lot of landscaping. And it's a little bit chocolate box and Disney in the sense that, you know, it's not a working farm yard. But the purpose is that you can look at some of the things that we've done and take a tiny bit of it away or be inspired or at least just have a go. So I can understand if somebody might say, oh, you know, I grew up on a farm and this is, you know, a bit perfect. But we've done that because we want it to be a really enjoyable space, a clean space, a relaxing space for people to come and realize the impact that nature can have. And that's, I think, like for me, I grew up on a farm, it's no big deal. I can sit in a pig yard and I still get that. But I think if you're a city slicker, try saying that after too much organic apple juice. And if you're a city slicker, then I think that leap can be a little difficult. I think you have to spell it out for people. Again, we're sometimes a bit lazy like that, but we need to be shown the difference.
It's lovely, and I think you're right that, in fact, it changed something for me as well, because I as people will know, I had the allotment until quite recently. I had to give it up because we moved away to a different house, and I can't drive 45 minutes to the allotment, so and back. So I had to say goodbye to all of that, and now I've got a little yard until we move to our proper farm thing. I've got a little yard, and I was a bit sad about giving up this lovely plot and all my plans for it. And then I saw you were growing a few potatoes in some raised beds and a couple of other things. And I thought, you know, I can do that in the yard. So I took some of the potatoes with me that I didn't get a chance to plant. And I took some of the leeks and some onions, and they're all growing in little grow bags and things in the back garden here. And yeah, it's not the all embracing plot of allotment and all of that, but it's something, and it's sure. Certainly better than nothing. I mean, far better than nothing. It's wonderful.
Good. Well, I think probably your comment is the most valuable part of what you've just said, is that it isn't about buying a farm. It's not about buying a small holding. It's not about upping sticks and moving to the countryside. It's about understanding what contact with nature does and gaining inspiration about the little things that you could take back. You know, I always think the analogy I often offer people when they ask about the Good Life Project, for example, and how they can put this great big piece of research, which is ongoing, into context in their own working environment. And so I would say, you know, you can be really interested in space and stars and planets, but you don't have to become an astronaut. You don't have to buy a spaceship. You don't have to work for NASA. You can buy a telescope. You could sit outside at night or lay on your back on the grass and look up. You could buy some DVDs on space or books or stick some posters up. You know, there are myriad ways to engage with something and still get the feeling of that sort of cooperative, collaborative, group beneficial feeling of being a part of something and learning about something. It doesn't have to be the whole hog. That's exactly the same as what we're doing here. You know, from, I suppose, the simplest thing would be to put a picture of something natural on your desk somewhere where you can see it all the time. And then you've got every intervention that you could imagine throughout the whole thing, you know, upgrade to a pot plant, upgrade to a view out of your window that's something natural, upgrade to a herb garden in your office, upgrade to a walking meetings or a running club or a allotment club, or upgrade to, you know, some seeds. We've got some free, oh, we could do that for your listeners. You could claim some free wildflower seeds. Maybe we should do that. We've got these packets of wildflower seeds that are bee friendly, because we keep bees here. I'm really, really, really pro planting for pollinators to increase bee populations, which are struggling. And of course, you benefit from that as well, because you get to see lovely flowers and you can pick the flowers if you want. And so it's kind of a win-win-win. And so you could sprinkle those wildflowers on a sort of patch of bare ground at work, or in a plant bed, or, you know, on a windowsill or whatever. Not obviously not on the windowsill, in a plant pot on the windowsill. So there's sort of, you know, loads of different ways, or upsticks and buy house in the country. So you can, there are lots of different mechanisms for taking part.
So this really feels like something that, you know, if someone fancies calling themselves a leader, this really feels like something that needs to be on their agenda, because like you said, the whole idea of leadership, leading people, leading on an initiative can feel really complex. You know, start talking about engagement surveys and emotional intelligence and all these special tricks and techniques that you need in order to get people's attention and in order to get them to care. And actually, it could be much more simple. And it could be as simple as, can we just think about the environment in which we work and make a few subtle changes? And for something that you could initiate for basically no cost, that sounds really simple to do with massive impact, right?
And it is phenomenally simple to do. I think that's the wonderful thing about it. You know, nature is so incredibly complicated. Now, I often look at, so on our barn, we have a wildflower roof. It's all sedum all across the top, which the bees love. And I look at those, the complexity of the stem and the petals, and I think, gosh, that started off as a, and you only really, I think, appreciate this when you grow your own. Either plant seeds or parsnips was the thing I found amazing. Parsnip seeds. Have you ever grown parsnips from a seed, Blair?
I've seen the seeds, yeah.
They're tiny. I mean, it's like a, well, it's like a seed you'd see blowing about in the wind. It's like, it's the thinnest, flimsiest, tiniest little seed. And yet it grows this root structure and leaves and this great big vegetable as well. And I just find that remarkable. So I often look at the sedum roof. Now, we have a sort of separate initiative of the Good Life Project called Bees for Business, which is about encouraging businesses to either adopt, buy, or rent beehives, honey beehives. And there are lots of different ways they can engage with that. They either, you know, learn to be a beekeeper and do it themselves, or we link them up with local beekeepers and they manage them for them, and they get the honey. They could give the honey to a community project, they could sell the honey, give it away as corporate gifts, blah, 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 blah. But the interesting thing is that there are so many analogies to honeybee colonies and hives directly to business, literally, like metaphor after metaphor after metaphor, like the way that the bees work together, the way they work independently, the different hierarchy and structure they have, but they seem to do it much better than humans do. Now, obviously, bees are a lot more simpler entity than a human, but I think there's an awful lot we can learn from them. And I often look at the two things, you know, the sedum growing and the bees all over it, and then think about the bees and the structure of the bees and how a honeybee colony is very similar to every organisation I've ever worked with, in fact. And I think it's just so simple, isn't it? It's just so simple. Just the simplest of things, and you just let it happen. The thing with human beings is we're not very good at renegating control. You know, we like to be in control. We like to think we have all the answers. And so when you hand training or hand well-being or health or behavior over to nature, and we don't fully understand it and it's phenomenally complicated, I think that's where the resistance comes from, is that, you know, I always tell people, if you don't understand why you're doing something, we get significantly less engagement and interaction because of that lack of cognitive and emotional understanding. And I think that's the same, is that's the barrier I see a lot, is that people say, but how does it work? You know, so we're going to encourage people to interact with nature. We're going to have our bee colony or whatever. We go out and see it. And people feel much better after it, but they don't know why. And so this is why, coming full circle, I felt the need for the Good Life Project to continue the research so that we had actual scientific evidence as to why it works. We know it works. There's shed loads of evidence to suggest it works, and we're producing that evidence too. But we're not entirely sure why. And that's the bit of research that we're focusing on at the minute, to fully understand why it is that the simple things in leadership, in management, in business, in life can make fundamentally quite extraordinary changes.
Well, I think that's a brilliant place to leave it, because the message is really clear that, and for me, one of the things I take from what you've just said is that people do seem to need to know the why, but actually when we spend a lot of time focusing on the why to do something that we deeply know is right. I mean, I can't imagine anybody listening to this and saying, I don't believe that being out in nature is good for us. Don't believe it. I can't imagine anybody listening to this and thinking that. I can imagine people saying, but we're not going to do anything about it in the workplace, or I don't know where to start, although frankly, you've made it very easy for them to start. But I think we all know instinctively and as human beings, the answer to quite a lot of these questions. And I wonder if in leadership too, that maybe one of the things that being with nature teaches us and being with animals teaches us and touching the soil teaches us is that this idea of control is an illusion of control, in fact. And yes. That, you know, this is something I learned actually on a equine guided leadership program, that you think you're making the horse do the thing. But frankly, you can't make a horse do anything. It's a really, really big animal. If it doesn't want to do it, the thing, it's not going to. Your measly little body is not going to make it do anything. And I think that's true with all of this stuff, that we actually have a lot less control than we think we do. And letting go of that need to control and letting go of the belief that we control it can be hugely liberating and actually create incredible results. It's not that we're giving up on having great results. It's just that we're working out how to access those results by having a bit less of this illusion of control.
Yeah, absolutely. I think it's, I often talk about leaders guarding an empty safe, and it's that exact thing. There's a perception that there is some sort of special secret to it. And actually, when you ask a group of leaders or managers to be honest, put the hand on their heart, raise their hands if they feel as a leader that they have 100% of the answers and the strategies for coping, that they feel they're totally there, like absolutely on it as a leader and a manager, you can throw pretty much anything at them and they're comfortable with it. And hardly anybody ever puts their hand up, because fundamentally the reason that people are leaders is because they were a very good something else. They were a great salesperson or sales director and said, oh, you should really, but let me put you into make you a manager, and you're attracted by the flattery, you're attracted by the probable increase in salary and the career development, but actually it's an entirely different role. That's why florists, and I'm not picking out florists individually, but it's why people with a skill often aren't very good business people, because running a business is a very different set of skills. You can be a great florist or baker or whatever, but it won't necessarily mean, say, you make a great business out of it, because they're two different skills. In the same way that whatever you were doing before you became a leader was something else, and you might have been brilliant at that, but it doesn't guarantee that you can be a leader, which is probably why you've got on your bookshelf The 1 Minute Manager and Who Moved My Cheese and a number of other leadership books, because you're still looking for the answers to developing.
And how can people follow you and your adventures on the farm?
Oh gosh, if you really want to. So my website is www.thebehaviorexpert.com, and there are links on there to the Good Life Project and the charity project, the Just One Project, and lots of other things. And then the Good Life Project has its own website, which is about to launch with a brand new shiny, there's loads of free resources. There's videos on there, infographics, research, all sorts of things to help you engage with nature in your workplace, and obviously some of the courses we've got are on there as well. And that is thegoodlifeproject.info, www.thegoodlifeproject.info.
Fantastic. Well, Jez, it's as ever so fun and interesting and energizing to you, and I just can't wait for how this is all going to evolve and what the impact's going to be on business. I mean, I can really imagine in a few years' time that certainly the companies that you've been working with and that have got their head around some of this stuff are going to feel dramatically different as a result.
But it's been amazing, Blair. It's been one of the best experiences of my life. Thank you for inviting me onto your podcast.
Thank you.
To hear from you, you can get all the episodes of this show, plus read the blog and find out more about our travel adventure at www.brilliantgamble.com. Sign up to the newsletter and get an advance notice of the classes and programs Mummy is running. Plus, you can follow us on Instagram and Twitter at Brilliant Gamble. Finally, please leave a review and star rating for this podcast on iTunes, as it helps people find us and take a brilliant gamble of their own.